So today is the last lecture, hooray. So today we'll talk about some future ideas about what is going on in programming languages that we're seeing now. It'll be not the most recent, but some trends that we can identify for programming languages. So what can we see in the future? We'll probably see more abstraction. But how do we achieve that next level of abstraction so that everybody can understand everything in a program? Right? That is fairly tricky. What is, for example, going on is to add more abstraction, go towards more domain-specific languages. Because if you're programming physics, you want to think in terms of physics and then achieve a level of abstraction by removing anything that is not physics-related. Anything internal to an implementation can be abstracted away from. Documentation is, of course, also important, right? How do we add documentation to a program, right? In such a way that when you change the code of your program, that the documentation is also changed automatically at the same time. There are new ways of thinking about how to construct programs. We talked a lot about this for the last few lectures. For example, component-based programming, communication, parallel programming. Let's get started. So one way of thinking about documentation is that documentation and code should not be too far apart. So you should not write two documents where you have your code of your program and documentation of your program completely separate, because these can drift apart, right? You change the code, but you forget to update the documentation. This is a very common problem. Or you update the documentation, because there's a documentation team who is separate from the programming team. The documentation team adds documentation without knowing what the code is doing at all. These are things that are actually happening, right? For example, in big companies, you have a separate documentation team, right? And they document what they think the program should do without looking at the actual code. Right? But the only thing that they are reading is the requirements documents from another team. Right? So there are now three teams at play: the requirements, overall design team, the documentation team, who are sometimes looking what the tests are doing. Right? You have a testing team who writes the tests, who do not talk to the documentation folks and who do not talk to the implementation folks. And then you have the implementation team who are doing their best at implementing the requirements. Right? And all of these teams are loosely coupled. And how do we make a better development environment? One way of doing this is, for example, by integrating documentation and coding in one platform. So I have one language where documentation and code are tightly weaved together in a single program. So what is, for example, Java doing? Java has JavaDoc, where before every function you can write a little bit of specially formatted documentation, and that specially formatted documentation is then spit out by this JavaDoc into HTML, which you can then read. So this is a good step forward from having separate documentation and implementation. Right? These are a little bit weaved together. With literate programming, these things are even more tightly weaved together. With JavaDoc, you have a bit of documentation per function or per class. And with literate programming, you have documentation or structured documentation per line of code. So every line of code in your program has a little bit of documentation weaved in. And then you have a program that pre-processes your source code and then can either extract the source code or can extract documentation. Right? So documentation must be extracted from these literate programs, or the source code can be extracted. Right? That's the idea. So NewWebs, CWeb are these literate programming tools. So JavaDoc is fairly simple. Yeah? You write a bit of structured documentation before every field or class or method, and these documentation fragments are then pulled out from the code. So this is still fairly loosely coupled. With NoWeb, it's a little more tightly coupled. So you write a documentation and the code in one file, tightly weaved together, and documentation chunks now start with a single ampersand, and then copied verbatim to LaTeX for creating a little bit of a professional style documentation. If you don't start something with an at, it should start with a code identifier, so you say smaller than name of your fragment of code, and then smaller than equals, and then start doing your C, Java, C++ bit of code. Right? So code chunks can then refer to other code chunks as if you were referring to documentation. So when you say name, you refer to a fragment of code or a fragment of documentation, and these are weaved together. So code does not have to be structured in the same way that you would write your code. You would not write lines of code one after the other to create your program. You can first explain how one piece of code works, then explain how some other piece of code works, and then some other piece of code, and another piece of code. And the weaver should place these fragments, or extract these fragments, and then place them in the source code in the correct order. Right, that is the idea. So the weaver does not just remove every bit of documentation. The code can be ordered in the way to best describe how the code works, and not in how it is accidentally placed normally. So here's a bit of literate programming code. So your program is a main and a foo function. Right? And main is a bit of code, right? It starts with a header, and then you have a bit of documentation, and then a bit of more code for describing what main is doing. Then foo is a function with a prototype, and then a bit of comment for describing how that next piece of code works, and then describe your code, the label for your code fragment. Right, and then either extract HTML or LaTeX and then format it, or we can extract the C code. Note that this bit of code is just for structuring documentation, it's not for structuring the code. Right? So literate programming is a way of mixing together code and documentation. Right? The next part of this is coordination. Right? How do I describe the coordination of a program? Right? What is coordination? So coordination I'll define as, well, a program is a set of glued together components, and we need to somehow coordinate how these components interact. So how to describe interaction between components. That is a coordination. So a Unix shell script is already a form of coordination language, right? You have some, for all inputs, do this, right? For internet aware, right? You want coordination also running over multiple web services. You have a web service for incrementing counters, and you have a web service somewhere else for booking tickets for flights and hotels and so forth. And a coordination language for the internet would be book a flight, get a hotel, increment the counter for my number of trips, and send a Twitter message, right? So this is coordination over the internet. And how can we write languages to program the internet as a distributed machine? Right, so Hermes is a start at the coordination language, right? Where, for example, we're going to book a ticket at a ticket service somewhere on the internet. Right, so we have a ticket service who is living at some URL. Right, and we need to describe how this service works, how this internet thing works for this server, how to interact with that server. Well, we exchange forms, right? One form is for describing what I want, where I want to go to, when I want to go, and I have an ACL for describing what I'm going to get as a result. Right, and who is allowed to do things for security reasons. Then I have to define a task. So first I describe how the server works. Now I want to use this service. I must describe how this service works. So I must have tasks for interacting with this servers. So for example, I have an input for describing who I am, and then an output stream for Basically, we saw HTML pages being exchanged, right? So I sent an HTML put and do an HTML get for getting some result back. And then I describe some attributes for my request and so on. Then once I've gotten my event, right, I sent my task, please do it. And then I get an event back from, yes, your ticket is booked. Or yes, this service has generated some result. Or even more intelligent, this service has made the price of my hotel a little bit cheaper. All right, so all these events, and I'm going to asynchronously apply to my transaction. Right? And then I must describe when I want to do something with a given event. So when an event comes in, how do I handle that event? Some asynchronous event. So for example, the price of a ticket has become a little bit cheaper, then I want to act on that event with a when statement. So when a travel agent starts to do something, then I want to book a ticket, start my ticket booking, then this travel agent's output service, so this service should be connected to that service, and I describe these bidirectional links so I can let one service talk to another service on the internet. All right, so now we have services on the internet that we can connect with each other. What is the next step? Well, we need to implement these services themselves. For example, and one way of doing this, a little bit modern, is components. So instead of having fine-grained objects, you have larger components for structuring your program. So a program is a set of communicating components. And a component is a set of objects internally most of the time. So a component has an interface. So when I send this object to the component, then I receive this object back from the component. Right? So instead of an interface to a component, and a component is mostly a set of objects internally. Right? And like an ADT, we should not touch the components internals. We should not touch the components' internal objects. But usually it's programmed in Java, something like this. But it's a level of abstraction higher. There are starts at component-based languages, where you define an abstract component consisting of a number of interfaces and objects, input and outputs. Another way of going to a higher level of abstraction is UML, for example. UML is not for describing objects, but rather a step of phases inside of a component. There's very few language support for components currently in languages. Interface description definitions. So interface definition languages. So if you describe a component, you should describe the interface to a component. How do I use that component? And we want to use that component as worth an ADT, right? It's an abstract data type. So how do we define an abstract interface to a high-level component? Right? What we, for example, can do is we want to be able to access such a component over the internet. We want to have a machine somewhere and have that internet accessible. Accessible via SOAP, for example, right? Via some high-level communication mechanism. We can do this, for example, via CORBA, but there are a number of other approaches. For example, flick and click for describing interfaces to components. We'll look at these in a little bit. So these interface definition languages we can see as a high-level interface to some components, sort of component interface. So CORBA is one way of describing interfaces to components. So it's, you describe what the functions are for my component. What can I call for this for triggering some action inside of a component? The objective here is to have multi-process, multi-machine programs, right? Internet services. The problem here is most of these interfaces you want to define in a language-independent way. So I want to implement a component in Java or Python or C or Java, and I want to be able to communicate with a component somewhere else, perhaps written in a different language. So I want to have a Java component on one machine talking to a Python or C component somewhere else? How do I language independently arrange for communication? What CORBA is doing is defining a abstract interface, and every language can then implement that interface in its own way. There are a number of problems with this mapping, however, right? So not all languages have the same concepts, right? For example, Java has exceptions, but C does not have exceptions, right? So there are a number of mapping problems when if you make this interface too general or too language specific, that you cannot map all of its concepts to the concepts in another language. So if I, for example, have objects, an object-oriented interface, and I want to be able to communicate with the service implemented in Haskell, then I have a problem because objects are very differently implemented in Haskell than they are in C++. So, this is, for example, this is a bit of an interface description for a CORBA service. So I have an interface to my service, hashing service, goes in a key and goes in a value, and I add it somewhere internally into my service. And I can get keys from my interface, for example. Right? So there are some sort of abstract interface. The problem here is language independence, right? We want CORBA to be implemented by different languages. So here I have an unsigned long key, but if I want to implement this service or this interface in a component written in Java, I have a problem because Java does not know unsigned longs. How do I handle that? What CORBA is doing is ignoring it. Ignoring always works, right? If you're not aware of the problem, then it doesn't exist. Ignorance is bliss. So the CORBA services, you can have multiple services at play. There is a naming service where you can look up where are the services that implement this interface with given this name. So given a name, give me an implementation of such an interface. And once you've gotten that interface, you can invoke the methods on it. In CORBA, this is a well-defined scheme for how to access these name services, what kind of protocols are sent over the network. This is all well-defined. So everybody knows what is going on the cable. So for example, the server registers an interface implementation with this naming service. A client wanting to use the service first calls the naming service from, please give me the implementation of the service somewhere who is implementing this name. Then you have the name and a remote reference, and given this remote reference, you can interact directly with the service. This is a fairly standard way of programming the internet. Everybody here should know this already. CORBA is a little more complex than just servicing interfaces. It also services, for example, exceptions. So you can use an exception inside of your interface. Right? So here I have an exception unknown, and this exception is thrown by here, by getQuote. Right? GetQuote can raise an unknown exception. Also, right, in these interfaces, I just don't only write integers or strings. I can send objects to as parameters to functions. So I must describe the objects or structures that are going over my network cable, so that every side, the sender and receiver, knows what kind of parameters are coming from methods. It is then the job of the CORBA network interface to describe how such a thing is laid out on the network, and the language on the sender and receiver are then responsible for packing and unpacking the structure to a language-specific format. So on Java, this would be an object, and on C, this would be a struct, and on Python, it would be a dictionary. Right? So polymorphic remote calls. What's the problem here? Say we have an object-oriented program. And this client and the server of these an application are programmed independently. So there's one group in München who is programming the server, and there's one group here in Erlangen who is programming the client. So these are completely separate development teams, and the only thing that they have exchanged is this interface definition. But this interface definition allows some flexibility. Let's say we have base object, and we have an interface where we send this base object over the cable. What we're now doing in Java is create a derived object of our base object and send an instance of this base object over the of this derived object over the network. The problem is that at the server side, it will now see an instance of the derived class coming in over the network cable, but it will never have seen the type. So the server will see types programmed by some arbitrary client who the server has no idea of what it is and what it should be doing with it. But however, it is type safe, right? Because the Java allows inheritance. So also inheritance over parameter types. So how do we handle this? What polymorphic remote calls should do is, if the server sees a type that it is unknown to him, it should request the details of this unknown type from the client. The client should reply with, oh, you don't know this type yet? Here is the information about this derived type. So this protocol internally is a little bit more complex. This is polymorphic remote types are implemented in Java RMI. They are not programmed in CORBA, because in CORBA, not all programming languages allow dynamic loading of types, right? You cannot do dynamic polymorphic function calls in C, right? This is a little bit tricky. So another problem that we need to tackle for the internet is versioning. And I write a version of my component, make it public to the internet, and after a while I see that I programmed the bug, and we should create a new version. Right now the problem is that some clients are able to talk to the old version of my interface, but cannot talk to the new version, right? Because the new version has different prototypes for what it can accept from the network, right? So in RPC gen, for example, is in Unix. Everybody, Unix should have an RPC gen, I think. So I can describe you my component and its interface, and I explicitly assign version strings, version numbers. So whenever I create an update to a function, I should increment this version number, and this should allow old clients to continue talking to my service over the old interface, and then new clients can talk to the new versions, right? Transparently. So I have upgradable services that are transparent and never die, right? So it never happened that the server crashes because it never has never seen a disk version of a client. There's multiple versions of clients at work. So everything is versioned. So the service itself is versioned, and the every method itself can be versioned as well. It's a little bit over-architected. So you allow program updates transparently with old versions still at play. This is very nice. It's a little bit of work to maintain these version numbers. It's also taught for the internet. It's fairly slow. So all this RPC gen and CORBA is fairly slow. Although CORBA is used by some Unix shells for internal operation, right? So we have CORBA, remote procedure calls for communicating between services inside a single machine. So it's not that inefficient, but there's a lot of inefficiency at play. If you want real high performance, you want to send lots and lots of messages, you need to have something lower level. So if I want to program a router, what is a router? A router takes packets from the internet and then sorts them, categorizes them, analyzes them, rewrites them, and sends them onward. Right? This is very low-level work, but it should be really fast, because a router can accept millions of packets per second, and a really high-performance router will take a million packets per second. Then we know what the router is doing, its functionality is fairly fixed, so we can program these things in a sort of fixed graph of components. So in Qlik, a program is a graph of components that are fixed in their topology. So you have input sources and they push their results to a lookup table task, and this lookup table task then pulls the results. So push and pull, and then push to different components and then send them out. So this is a fairly simple router. You take two inputs, take a packet, look at its header of the packet, and if the packet says I need to go to Asia or I need to go to the USA, then you port it to different output ports. So this is a simple router, and then you have a FIFO queue to not overload the output channel, right? Because output channel is perhaps busy. So what kind of component types are we then looking at? Component, more like communication paths. So I have a scheduler. So this is in the middle box here is a scheduler who chooses one of its inputs for forwarding. So this is a scheduler who looks at its inputs, takes one of its inputs for what it thinks is the most has the most priority. For example, if the middle guy is high priority and the other two guys are low priority, then it should most often look at the middle box for taking its inputs. So it has a sort of scheduling priority, right? Perhaps there's a sort of fairness criteria where every box should be equally important and we should guarantee that every input has its own the same probability of being forwarded to the output. This is a classifier, right? Packets come in, look at the packet, and then see if it's type A, B, or C, and then route it toward output bay in A, B, C. Or a simple forwarder, where most of the time you take an input, you transform it a little bit, and then send it output. This is, all of this is fairly efficient. It's really efficient. You get packet routing performance that is almost on par with handwritten code. So if you write C code by hand, you get just about the same performance as something programmed as a language is click. It's really performance, and you can fairly portably write your code. So click, there's this little language involved in describing how these boxes are connected to each other. Right, you have a source, your declaration of your boxes, right? Of your sources and your targets and your routers and so forth. And then you describe how these boxes are connected. So from the packet source, I send my packets to the printer component, and the printer component print my packet and then discard the packet. So discard is also a component. So components are somehow routed together. For example, from device my VLAN controller, send my packet to this printer component, and then discard the packet from the discarding component. So I can now print all the packets that come into my wireless card. Right, so you can do very nice tricks here if you're at the airport and you want to see what everybody else is doing. With five lines of code, you can filter out packets coming from everybody on the airport, sort them nicely, have a nice graph for seeing what everybody else is doing. Right, this is very nice. There's also components for printing pictures, right? So I have a component here. From all packets in the airport, print all the pictures that are coming by over my wireless network. That's very nice. You can see what everybody else is doing. Right, for example, this is a run, right? So I do the same program as before, right? And run it and I see all the packets come by. So a packet is 1466 bytes for a TCP packet, and then these are the first few bytes of every packet coming by. So this is the packet header, and here we see a little bit of content coming by. Some little more complex examples. So I have a round robin scheduler where for a time source where every 0.2 seconds or every half a second I pull the network card, for example, then put the packets into a queue. This queue has a maximum length of 20 elements, and then print whatever packet is coming by and send that to this round robin scheduler. So I have packets coming in periodically and then send the output towards a round-robin scheduler for accepting one or the other input. And then I send this packet to a stream. Or from a device, select all IP packets, strip the Ethernet packet header, right? Check if it's a correct IP header, filter all the ICMP packets out, so I don't care about summing packets, and then print all of these packets out. So I can see all the important packets going over the network, ignoring all the network discovery packets that don't really interest me. I'm only interested in packets that have some useful content. Okay. Agents. So components are inactive things, right? They're not active. They are to do something with a component, you have to actively ask it to do something. An agent is a more active component, so an active component where every agent has a is active. It has its own thread of a control, and it's an abstract component, so you can't look at the inside. Outside of sending messages between them. So agents communicate by sending messages to other agents. Whenever you send a message to another agent, it is put into its mailbox. And an agent can sometimes look at its mailbox to see if it has mail. And if it has mail, it can extract this mail and then invoke a method. Right? So for example, traffic simulation, right? So you have independent things in reality, right? Every traffic light is independent, every car is independent, right, and so forth. So these are nicely modeled with agents. Every car is an agent. And it looks outside its environment and sees if for events. So the event should model this the other way around. So environment sends messages to the car. Now I see you coming, right? There is a car in front of you, so the car in front of you sends a message to the car in back saying, you are in front of me, and so forth. So you actively send messages between each other to inform each other of the environment. Right? In the end, every agent has some idea of its environment and can act on its belief what its environment is. Right? That's the idea. Marvin Minsky is one of the big shots in the artificial intelligence world. Right, and he already said that the brain is a set of interactive agents. If that's true, I don't know. But he's the big shot. I'm not. So agents. So every agent is an autonomous object. You cannot directly invoke a method on another agent. Right? You have to send messages for communication. So requests or for information or for action is then put into a mailbox of another agent. Agents speak is one of these agent-based systems. So every agent has a belief, also what he thinks the environment or its of himself is. So I'm in a car, a car is an agent. This car needs to know if it's on the road, if it is near a stoplight, is there how much distance is there between him and the next car, how far it should still travel, right? In which direction? So every agent has some sort of belief. It has a desire. Right? Everybody in a car wants to go home. Right? He wants to go to work. Right? Every agent has some belief what its environment is, some desire for what it wants to achieve, and some intentions or strategy of how to achieve those desires on the, given that belief. So we program that in a form of logic language. So I'm an agent. I believe that X3 holds, and my belief is that Y holds, and I want to execute plan Z. Right, so I have some sort of simple description language for describing how agents should behave. So I can test goals with writing an ampersand or a question mark for what I want to achieve. Then I have goals that I want to achieve and have triggering events for implementing strategies. So plus is for if I want to go to the concert and I like this concert, then I must book tickets for going to this concert, and then I feel some pleasure. Now, this feeling pleasure is a little bit abstract. This is artificial intelligence, right? So how do I, the more pleasure I feel, I want to do more of it. So another example, I have two robots cleaning my room. I have a garbage disposal somewhere, right? I want to move all my trash towards the garbage disposer. And how do I work? So I have one agent, so one robot, that picks up the garbage wherever it is and gives it to the other robot. And the other robot should place my garbage in the garbage disposal. So I have robots moving around, and these robots communicate by giving garbage to the from one robot to the other robot, or to the garbage disposal. Right. So I given some garbage for robot two. I know that I want to move that garbage around, so I always know what to do, and I do that by burning that garbage, for example. Right, so there's a little bit of code here for, you don't really need to read it, but the idea here is you have some sort of strategy for achieving your goals and your desires. And this is programmed more or less like Prolog. So this is like Prolog with extensions for a bit of fuzzy logic for desires, how to achieve desire and feelings. Right, KQML is another route towards agents. So now again, I have agents communicating between each other. It's remote procedure call based, right? Instead of having a more abstract mailbox, I have an explicit mailbox. And you send messages between these agents. So I have a performative, right? So I want to do that, and I have these arguments towards whatever I want to execute. So I'm sending messages with parameters. So, for example, Smith sends a message with, I want to know the price of a stock, and I send that to the stock server, and I should reply with the amount of stock that I just bought, and the language for the server is Prolog, and ontology is I want to execute this query in this stock market environment. Or here I just asked one service for an answer. I can ask every service for an answer. For all the stock markets in the world, please buy me stock. And when you buy your stock, I want to know how much you should pay for that stock, right? And here is the reply of one of these queries. You sent a reply for some message format. So this is very much message-oriented programming, right? You create a message, send it on its way, and then the service or your partner should reply with a given message back in some way. So the implementation of how to do things is separated from the messages that are exchanged. So memo is another way of a little more higher level. So we started with low level Prolog, and we're now moving upward in abstraction. So memo is even more high level for doing agents, where you describe a model, you describe a number of agents that are at work, then you describe an agent just as you would do a Java object. Because you describe, I have an agent, it's an active thing, and this agent can respond to subscribe messages. So somebody can send a subscribe message to this agent dump. And then instantiate a number of agents, a dumb and dumber, and then an initialization, create some agents, and then send subscribe and another subscribe message to these two agents. So it send messages to agents, and they can reply when they have time for answering your messages. Right, so agents are autonomous. Every agent can run somewhere on the internet. You never say anything about location here, right? You never say, please run this agent on that machine. All of these agents are abstract, so they can run wherever they should run. So the high-level vision of agents is I create an agent, it goes somewhere on the internet to do whatever I want it to do, and then replies back when it's done. So instead of creating a search engine, for example, I have agents who go out into the internet to find the information that I want. So instead of having a centralized Google, I have a distributed Google. Right? I create an agent, please find me this information that I want. I send that agent in the internet, it goes everywhere, moves around the internet, and when it's done, this agent returns to me and it replies me with the answer of my search query. So instead of Google, I have a distributed Google. That's the high-level vision here. So parsing. There are a number of programming problems that are very successful in the world. Parsing is one of the more of the algorithms that are really mature and we know how to do. We know how to parse something and do it in a good way, even if the input is somehow ambiguous, we have a fair idea of how to do it. Even parsing natural language is mostly done. The amount of research being done for natural language programming or natural language parsing is I'm not saying it's really finished in this research, but we fairly know how to perform parsing for natural language even. So given some form of structured text, we need to parse it, extract some semantics or the structure at least, and then do some analysis and then return an answer. Right, so instead of saying that programming an application is a set of communicating components or agents, you say a program has some input and some output. And this input is structured some way and it should perform its output in some way. So this is another way of looking at programs. Right? So how do we perform parsing? First you need to describe a grammar. What is my input? What is my input? What is my allowable input? Mostly you write a grammar where you say I have a number of rules, I have a number of terminals, and a number of non-terminals. And these non-terminals can expand towards other terminals and non-terminals. So I have a generative grammar. Right? So I have stars for saying some expression can occur zero or multiple times, plus for I can accept E and the input for one or more times, and I have non-terminals for this must be an X on the input, so it must verbatim on the input. This is an example for a simple grammar. Right, so I have an expression is an expression plus another expression, and I can give names to these expressions, so these returned expression trees. So I have what is called an attribute grammar, right? I attributize this formal grammar with names and actions to be performed on whenever you've parsed something. So whenever I have parsed an expression plus another expression, the semantics of evaluating that rule should be plus x comma y. Right? So I have a description of the grammar and description of what to do once you've parsed that rule. Right? So the semantics and the formatted input are then somehow connected. Right? Semantic predicates. So a semantic predicate is then a rule for describing when that rule is allowed dynamically. So you describe a grammar rule and you say this grammar rule only applies if this condition holds. So you have conditional evaluation of rules inside of your grammar. And mostly you can group these rules together. For example, here I've grouped these sets of rules together under a given name. Now I have rules of grammars, of a grammar inside of blocks, and I can enable single or disable single rules in my grammar. So there's a lot of dynamism yet in parsing. But in the next step that I can do is to perform inheritance. So I can inherit one grammar from another grammar to extend the grammar. Right? So for example here, C++ inherits from the C parser, because C++ is a superset of C. Right? So one grammar can inherit from another grammar by adding its rules to the base grammar. So just like we had with inheritance, we can have inheritance for grammars. And we have dynamic statements, like if statements in a normal programming language, by using semantic predicates for enabling and disabling rules in the grammar. So do we really need to write programs? If a program is only take some input and produce some output, then we don't really need to write any C++ code in the middle. Right? All of this can be generated by only declaratively saying, if you see this on the input, then it should be parsed with that grammar rule, and this semantic action should be invoked, and that can produce some given output. So if the program is only doing input to output transformations, we can remove any kind of implementation code and just declaratively generate our entire program. That's the idea. Can also have higher level programming, so higher order productions. So what was a higher order function in C or C++? There were function pointers, right? So we can have one function as an argument to another function. In terms of grammar rules, we can have grammar rules that have other grammar rules as arguments. So we can it's not like invoking a grammar rule. It's a grammar rule with another grammar rule as an argument. Higher order grammar rules. For example, where do we do this here? So when do we allow a correct printf statement? When is a printf statement in C correct? A printf statement in C is correct if every %d matches to an integer argument, and every %f matches to a floating point argument. Right? So we have the formal grammar of C, but we also have a sort of sub-grammar, right? We need to test if arguments match the if parameters match to the arguments, right? Such style of arguments, it doesn't really fit into the C grammar. It's sort of higher level grammar, where first we parse the C code and then we parse if the arguments match the formal parameters. So we have sub-grammars even over a real grammar. Okay. Something like Ometa is fairly low-level work. It's not internet-enabled. Internet is good. Everybody should be doing internet. So XQuery is the next step. XQuery is for doing parsing over XML documents. So an XML document is, everybody here knows XML and HTML anyway. So you write some HTML, and inside of your HTML, you can call functions. So call a local function, hello, and I declare that XQuery function directly in my HTML. What happens here is this XQuery works by substitution. So it takes whatever the output of this function is, and this function will take some XML arguments and return some more XML. So the result of evaluating an XQuery function is XML. So if an XQuery function takes XML and returns XML. Huh? And it works by substitution. So whenever you invoke a function, it is replaced. It executes this function, and then its return value replaces wherever this was called. So this returns some value, XML, and this XML this line of text here is substituted here. So cut, paste, right? So via cut, copy, paste, I can then transform XML to new XML. You see that here, right? So paste with the correct values. So the next step. The return statement in XQuery is not like a return statement as you know it in Java. In Java, the return statement has two functions. The return statement in Java returns out of the current function, but it also returns the value, right? So there are two steps. Assign the expression, the returned value to the function, and then return out of the function. So there are two steps involved in a Java return statement. Here, the return statement only assigns to the return set. So every function has a set of return values, and whenever you say return x, it is only adding the x to the return set. It does not actually return. So here, I have a return statement which returns some XML. And this XML is then substituted by every invocation. But instead of returning, it just adds this XML to the return set. So this return set for hello is growing every time you execute the return statement. So here we have, if we evoke that statement four times, then four items added to our return set. So this is our return answer. Right? The return set is added by copy-paste. So for example, for Fibonacci, right? How do we use XQuery to create a nice table in XML for Fibonacci? Right, I have a starts at the bottom. I invoke a function, make table. This make table has some table border and table end, right, for returning our headers. Then I create a for loop. Every for loop iteration, I should return a bit of XML for formatting every line in this table. And then I have the actual faculty function for computing the entry in a table. Right? So now I can execute functions, take XML and get XML back and create nicely formatted XML as a result. So XQuery is not only for a generative, it is not only there for generating XML, it is also for queries, right? And query, XQuery, doing queries. So given a XML, we can also interpret that XML as a database. And now we have a nicely formatted database of tables of items. But every table can have different values. So it's a little more, it's not like a relational database per se, but it's more unstructured. So how do we traverse such an XML? There's an accounting table, and this accounting table has an orders table and a sales table. This is how we should interpret this thing. So given an XQuery function for in this document purchases.xml, go to the accounting table, and from the accounting table select all the sales items. And all of this is XML, so it immediately copy-pastes the XML from the query into the output. And this is then our result, right? So it's a fairly nice way of writing SQL-like code inside of XML. Right. So another example. Here I have some more XML-like syntax. So from our table of sold items, for all the items in our set where some constraint holds, sort the table and return the sorted table at the end, so I can have more SQL-like syntax inside of our XML format. Right? There's even a bit of parsing involved. Right? You don't really need to do parsing because XML is already parsed by the internals of XQuery. But you can have a sort of parsing-like syntax for select all the items or the first item, or is there an item at all, or I want the every second item, and so forth. So for all the items in our database, find the largest item. And the largest item is then for all items where something holds, and so on. You can have then regular expressions for iterating over tables. RSpec. So let's go back to program development. How do I normally program or develop a program? I don't start by immediately, most programmers do not start by writing the leaf functions and then work their way back towards main. Right? You do not start by writing your cosine functions and your low-level functions and then work your way back up bottom to top until you have main implemented. You start by doing the high level design, and in this high level design you then refine and refine and refine until you have the complete program. Right? So most programmers do development of applications by gradual refinement, right? That is how it most of the time works. So a next step, another way of approach here is by writing tests. So you, so test-driven development, where you first write your tests, and then you refine your tests until all the tests work, and then you have your application as a byproduct. So this is behavior-driven development. In behavior-driven, every time you see behavior, you should read test. So this is test-driven development, or behavior-driven development. So the idea here is you write your specification or your tests in an abstract level by describing scenarios. You say a scenario, if I click this button, then the file should be saved. If I click this button, then my robot arm should start moving. Right? So you write a number of scenarios, and first you abstractly interpret these scenarios with an interpreter, and then every time you do a little bit of refinement by making these scenarios more and more concrete, until there is actual C++ code running your scenarios. And if every scenario works, then you have a correct program where all the requirements are then implemented. So here are some scenarios. Let's say I want to create a blogging application. So I have a story, right? As a blogger, I want to post something to somebody else's blog so that at the end somebody else can read my blog entry, right? And then there are a number of scenarios. If I am logged into the blogging platform, then I should be able to post something if I have access rights. If I am not logged into the system, I should be able to view blogs, but I should not edit blogs, and so forth. So I have a number of scenarios and tasks via these storylines. Right? So the next step. Right? So make this a little more concrete. So first, when I've created a story, when creating a post as a user, I want to post to my blog so that I can do my friends, share information, and so on. And then I create a number of scenarios, logged in as user, given, and, when, and this is almost like program code. Right? I can execute this. Logically, I can execute this. I cannot interpret no blog posts in the system yet, right? This is. But the trick that they are using is by giving these things as strings, right? These are effectively method names. This is the trick that they do. Here, given is a function call where this is a method name. So instead of having small function names, you just create your function names as strings, as descriptive strings. So this would almost work in Java, right? So this is like, this is almost Java code. If you interpret I create as a blog post, not as a string, but as a name of a function to call. That's a trick. So I can execute these abstract scenarios, even if they have no implementation whatsoever. I can execute these abstract scenarios, and whenever you see some string, you interpret that as a function call towards another scenario that should be executed. And if you have some input that is required, you just ask the user, please give me some input. So I can run this blog post scenario. It says story creating a post and then whatever I want to do. And then there, if I have to execute a scenario, there are things unimplemented yet. So there's pending things for please implement. So whenever you see pending, it says to the programmer, please refine this. You still need to refine this bit of code. So there's a stepwise refinement involved. So given a scenario with some abstract things that I should be able to do, I then replace some sort of abstract thing over there by an actual implementation. So need a post was I just paste my bit of Ruby code or bit of Python code, just place it in there, and then continue running. So how do these stories work? Well, as I said, all of these given and so forth are actually method names that I need to invoke. And I can all the time replace one of these abstract things with actual implementations. Right. So for example, here I have a bit of abstract scenario and then place some concrete code in the middle. And then somewhere else, I can just call shoot render shopping HTML. I can just call this scenario in a given location. Okay, all these scenarios are still a lot of work to create. It's constructive. It's a constructive way of doing this. So I need to think about structuring my program. I cannot just play around and make my program. So I need to, it's not very playful. Right? I don't have any fun doing scenarios. Making scenarios is not fun. What I want to do is just start with an empty application and then click around until it works. Right? That's the idea of live sequence charts. I start with an empty screen and then I place a button on there, and then by giving examples of what this button should do, describe what the final application should do. So the longer I use my application, I give more examples to the system how it should work. I just continue playing with my empty application until the system learns how the implementation should be. So behind these live sequence charts, there is an artificial intelligence going on for learning how events, click a button, should correspond to saving a file, right? So whenever I click on a button, I should give an example of how to save a file. Right? And by giving these examples and triggers, the system should learn how the application should behave. So every noob should be able to click a program together by just playing with it and giving examples how it should work, and at the end, have a final application running. This is of course, extremely futuristic, right? But the plan is nice. The vision is completely clear. Okay. Let's step away from the really far future and go towards what is currently available. What is currently available is multi-core. Multi-core is just multiple processor cores, and the only sense of all of these cores is if I can actually use these cores to make my program faster. So how do I create programming languages that make it easy to do parallel programming? I do not want to think about lots of low-level details when I'm creating my program. I should concentrate on the program logic, the business of my program, and the low-level stuff like, please copy this variable over there on that GPU, CPU, copy that from there to there on an efficient way. All of these low-level details I don't want to care about. I want to think about high-level things. Right? So how do we push parallel programming towards high-level programming? So there are Xtend is a set of extensions to Java for easier parallel programming. It's still under development, this whole thing, Xtend. But this bit of Java code is just as well Xtend code. So it's fairly similar to Java programming. It extends with multidimensional arrays for more efficient array access. You have parallel loops, immutable objects. And immutable objects are read-only objects. So you can construct an object with calling its constructor, but after the invocation of the constructor, this object is read-only for the world. So you cannot change an object anymore. It makes it easy to create replicas of objects. There's asynchronous evaluation of expressions. So it's easy to create parallelism. And there are lightweight tasks. There are no race conditions because concurrent accesses to data items are wrapped into transactions in the current implementation. You can never write a null pointer exception because all of the references are by default non-nullable. If you want a reference that can be null, you must mark it as explicitly as nullable. And nobody writes nullable to its code so that in the end, there are no null pointer exceptions. There is a low probability of null pointer exceptions then. There's a partition global address space. So if you have immutable data that is replicated everywhere, and if you have multiple machines or multiple graphics cards, every graphics card has its own address space. Every machine has its own address space. So you have what they do is make a distinction between local address spaces, so we can optimize towards locality, and they provide a shared memory abstraction as well, So shared memory program or distributed programming is not as hard as just giving the local machines only. There are asynchronous activities. So you can have an asynchronous for loop where every for loop, where this for loop statement runs at somewhere else, at some other place. So this is, it's very easy to start an activity on a GPU or on another machine, for example. So finish is waiting for all of these asynchronous activities to finish. So start a finish block, starting a lot of parallel activities, and at the end of this finish block, it waits for all of these parallel activities to finish. There are atomic blocks. So whenever you try to access shared data from multiple concurrent activities, all of this is securely handled. So you don't have to think about locks or semaphores. You just say, I want to execute this thing atomically, and internally it should do it somehow. They are not clear about what the semantics should be for these atomic blocks, if they want transactional memory, or if it should be transparent to whatever it is implemented in. I'm thinking about this. So there are futures. We saw this already by what we saw in the silk language, right? You spawn a number of parallel activities. These deliver a future, and you can then wait for whatever is spawned in the background to finish using this force method invocation on the future. Also, Xten also had multidimensional arrays, but we do not want any kind of bounce checking to occur at runtime, right? We do not want to see to check all the time that this array index fits into this array bound, right? All of this overhead we don't want to get rid of. So what they do is giving these multidimensional arrays bounds, explicit bounds, and then index these arrays with these bound types. So you can index a multidimensional array with a multidimensional point in this domain for this array. Right, you have points that you can index a multidimensional array with. So a region is then a region in a multidimensional space, right? And can then have points inside of such a region, and then can then declare arrays of that fit such a region size. So I declare a region, two-dimensional region, and then declare an array which fits these dimensions. So I don't have to index an array always with index 0, such as we do in Java, or index 1, as we do in Pascal or Modular. The trick then is, if I declare a point, I can, at the compile time, most of the time, statically check that this point fits into this space, so this point will never require a bounce check, and then get a little bit of performance back. So never have an array bounce exception, if the compiler can prove that it never occurs. So for every, so if I have regions, right, I can do data parallel execution. So what was data parallel again? Data parallel execution is, for every item in my data structure, invoke a function. And then we have data parallel for statements by saying, for every point in my region, do something. And if you do that in parallel, it is data parallel. So we have data parallel statements inside of Xten. Right, so for every point I, j inside of my region, please do some code. So if you make that explicit for each, instead of just for, we can make an explicit parallel for without the compiler having to prove that this for can be executed in parallel. Okay, this was all very general. This is all general purpose languages. What I see for the future is that people will be generating more just domain-specific languages, mainly because it has become very easy to create a domain-specific language. I can create a domain-specific language for a specific domain in a day. Inside of a day, I can create some domain-specific language because there are very nice tools for creating DSLs. For example, there is Xtext. Xtext is a, with Xtext you create a grammar of your language, and then click a button, and then it, it creates an Eclipse plugin for your grammar, which, and this Eclipse plugin will then highlight your code with colors in your, like Java, the Eclipse JDK. In Eclipse, you have this GDT for editing Java code inside of Eclipse. This is the Eclipse plugin for Java, JDT. And you can create with Xtext, but just creating a grammar of your DSL. You click on a button, and it generates the complete Eclipse plugin. So to sketch this, you write your grammar. Grammar. From that, you give that to Xtext, and from that it generates the complete Eclipse plugin. So this is generates. You write this grammar, and it generates the complete Eclipse plugin for your language. All of this is generated. This is syntax color highlighting. With a little bit of extra, with an extra DSL, you write your formatting. So auto format works for your new language. Your everything is colored correctly. You have copy paste support, file save, as everything that Eclipse requires for a new language, is automatically generated by just writing a grammar. Everything is generated. Just write your grammar for your new language, click a button, and a complete Eclipse environment is generated. You don't have to write anything. So making a new domain-specific language will only be easier in the future. So this is what I see as an opportunity for programming languages. Create a new domain-specific language and click on a button, it's done. What is missing in this tool chain is semantics. So just writing a grammar does not say anything about what the semantics of things is in this grammar. It just says what the syntax of your language is. It doesn't say anything about the semantics of what how things should function. Right? So that is missing in this tool chain, the semantics of things. If that is added to something like Xtext, then it can automatically generate a compiler for your language as well. Now, imagine this, right? You just write your grammar, a little description about how everything should work in your domains, in your language. Click a button and automatically debugger is generated. Your Eclipse plugin is generated, compiler is generated, the profiler generated, the whole editor is generated. So creating a new language in the future will be immensely easy. Right? This is what I see. So to give a little idea about what the use is for a domain-specific language, I'll present to you a domain-specific language for writing games. For example, for board games. So what is required for a board game? I need to describe what the things are on my board, how big this board game is. For example, if I have tic-tac-toe, right? This is a simple game. I have a 3x3 board, and I have pieces where a piece is either an X or an O on my board, right? And to solve a tic-tac-toe, right? And just try and set a mark on an X or an O somewhere on the board. A new mark is find an empty field to replace. If there's empty field, then I can place my own X or an O on that piece of the board. And if I have three in a row, diagonally, horizontally, then I have one. And three in a row is find my own mark, and in any direction, by going in that direction two times, there is the same mark. Then it's three in a row and I have one. So this describes entire tic-tac-toe. So now from this thing, I can generate automatically an automatic player for tic-tac-toe. So I don't have to write any Java code. I don't have to write any C++ or anything else. Given this description of this, you cannot make this description for tic-tac-toe any smaller. And for chess, and Go and so forth, for all of these board games, the idea is mostly the same, right? They have a very small description for how the board should look like and how to do things with this board. from this board, I then, well, for example, for chess, for a knight's move, is find my own knight, pick it up, go orthogonally one step, then two steps left, right, up, and so forth. If you describe how a chess board would run with all of its types of things that you can have on this chess board, and they can automatically, from a description of all the moves that you can make, automatically generate a chess player with a GUI, with parallel execution. If you have multiple machines, then it automatically generates something to solve chess with multiple machines at the same time.
Can it also automatically generate a learning chess player?
It's abstract. What it does is learning, yeah. It generates a solver for your chess game internally, and what it does is first brute force, and it tries to learn from what its brute force moves has made for success. So there is some sort of intelligent solver in the background. But the trick here is you have a domain-specific language, describe at high level what it should do, and then generate all the rest for the implementation, and it's flexible, right? Can generate some, use multiple machines at the same time, and so forth. So that's the end of the lecture. And I'll see you at the examination.